So, as I sort of blurted out during at the end of Robert's lecture, all roads are leading to 8 supercharges today. I'm not going to get to 4 supercharges. So we saw 8 supercharge theories show up briefly at the very end of Robert's, and Dan finally got up to 8 supercharges at the end, and I'm going to spend today doing 8 supercharges. So I was discussing the 5-dimensional theories that you get by formulating M theory on a Calabi-Yau manifold, so X is a Calabi-Yau threefold, on this Calabi-Yau manifold cross R14. And I mentioned that there were 2 kinds of moduli, 2 kinds of parameters, which came from the 2 different kinds of hypermultiplets that have, excuse me, 2 different kinds of multiplets that have scalars, which are the vector multiplets and the hypermultiplets. And I haven't said too much other than this little discussion that we had about how you're supposed to put the hypermultiplets together with the gravity and somehow get a metric with this particular property. I haven't said too much about how you would study the space of hypermultiplets. I've been focusing on vector multiplets, and I'm going to continue to do that. But let me just make one remark, which is that in 3 dimensions, vector multiplets and hypermultiplets are dual to each other. And so there's not too much of a distinction between vector and hypermultiplets. So if I work not just with the M theory on X cross R14, but if, for example, I work with M or 2A, let me just do it in 2A language, on X cross S1 cross R21, getting down to 2 plus 1 dimensions, on such a model, well, what's happened is that the vector multiplets, which in 5 dimensions had a real scalar, in 4 dimensions have a complex scalar, and down in 3 dimensions have a quaternionic scalar. And those vector multiplets now look very much like the hypermultiplets do. We can use that idea to indirectly study the structure of the space of hypermultiplets by means of vector multiplets up in higher dimension and then compactifying down. If we remember that in the case that there exists a mirror partner, this would be the same thing as 2B on X prime cross S1 cross R21. If X prime is the mirror of X. But then that, by T-duality, is the same thing again as 2A on X prime cross S1 prime, where you had to change the size of the S1, cross R21. And that could be thought of as dimensional reduction, further compactification from the M theory on X prime. Now, what happened during the mirror symmetry is that the vectors and hypers got reversed. So, what I should say rather is that the here, right here, the vector multiplets are represented by H11x in some form or another, and here the vector multiplets are represented by H11x prime. And the hypermultiplets are more or less represented by H21x prime, whereas here the hypermultiplets are represented by H21x. Well, that mirror symmetry step reverses the roles of H11 and H21. So I can take the hypermultiplets that I'm not telling you too much about, think of those as having been the 3-dimensional vector multiplets in this model on X prime, and then try to describe things more fundamentally in terms of vector multiplets there. You may miss some phenomenon that have to do with things that show up in 4 or 3 dimensions that didn't show up in 5 dimensions. There are such phenomena, but I'm not really going to have time to talk about them very much, and nor have they been investigated as systematically as the structure of the vector multiplet moduli space. So then in my discussion of the enhanced gauge symmetry, so one point which I forgot to say is that of course, the philosophy is that the string theory or M theory, compactified on the collabial, provides a model at high energies, which is gauge theory at low energies. As was reviewed this morning, there isn't a good quantum theory of gauge theory in dimensions beyond 4. And so we should really regard this kind of approach to singularity as a way of discussing a high-energy version of a theory which looks like gauge theory at low energy. In that regard, I should also point out that what we did in studying this gauge theory is we looked at a singular model of the collabial, so we took a kind of limiting metric, Gij approaches Gij0, some family, where this is no longer a metric, but X bar has singularities along, well, remember this was the case of contraction of a surface to a curve, so it's along some algebraic curve or Riemann surface, sigma. And the area of sigma corresponds to the Yang-Mills coupling constant in this formulation in such a way that strong coupling corresponds to small area. So the limit that we're taking, corresponds to small area. So we're taking a limit in which some fibers of this map are being shrunk to zero size, but you can also talk about the base of that family of P1s, and the size of that base is what indicates what the coupling is in the effective low-energy gauge theory. The other thing which I forgot to say about the gauge theory case is that depending on the matter content, so for appropriate matter content, in other words, appropriate specification of either the genus of the Riemann surface sigma or the types of singular fibers that you might be encountering in that bundle over sigma, for appropriate matter content, there also exists a Coulomb branch. In other words, X bar has deformations of complex, new deformations of complex structure, which would smooth out or partially smooth out the singularity. So that's very similar to what happened in the case of contracting isolated curves to points where, as I said, in that case, under the circumstance that you had some homology relations among the curves that were being contracted, then there was actually a deformation of complex structure, which was a new deformation. And the same thing is happening here. So the picture is, I mentioned that the vector multiple moduli space really does end there in some appropriate sense. We could make a double cover of it in real geometry. So make some double cover, getting a picture similar to the one that we had before, where these are now related by some reflection in some axis. And then out of this, then we would have a very similar picture, where out of this locus would grow another component of a different kind of collabial manifold with different Hodge numbers. But then, of course, there's an overall Z2 that we have to mod out by. After having described the space this way. So I think this is probably the best way to describe the space. It's some real manifold that has a reflection on it, and then also some new deformations which occur in the hypermultiplet space coming out of that, and you have to mod out by Z2 at the end. So the principle that I would like to formulate, which there's a fair amount of evidence for, is that if a collabial acquires singularities, and this acquisition of singularities could happen on the boundary of the projectivized Kähler cone, or, in fact, it should also be true in the complex structure moduli space, and I want to look at singularities which are at finite distance with respect to the metrics involved. And there's a theorem which says that that's the same thing as what are known as canonical singularities in the Veit-Peterson metric. So if a Calabi-Yau acquires singularities, then there is a field theory description, or some kind of newfangled field theory description of the relevant degrees of freedom which only depends on the local structure of the singularities. Local structure of the Calabi-Yau. So the first example of this principle is the study of ALE spaces rather than just studying rational double points on K3 surfaces, where although if you're going to insist on global models where you're really truly compactifying certain dimensions, you need to work with K3 surfaces that have only the allowed collection of rational double points. In fact, you can study the theories that are associated to rational double points which never can occur on K3 surfaces, like AN for very large N, by the same principle, looking at the local structure of the singularity. And as was true for the K3, where for the ones which can be embedded on K3s, where the structure appears only to depend on the local type of singularity, that should also be true even for the singularities that can't be globalized. So the same principle seems to apply here, where the kind of things that the kind of phenomena that we should be studying really have to do with the behavior of these canonical singularities. So the mathematical problem, which is not fully solved, would be to classify canonical singularities and then the physics problem, corresponding physics problem, would be to explain the physics of each type. So one type which is going to come up can be viewed as strong coupling limits of these regulated gauge theories. Well, maybe I should be working in four dimensions where I wouldn't have to worry about all these issues about the fact that I don't really have a gauge theory at high energy. But anyway, we have this way of finding certain kinds of singularities on Calabi-Yau manifolds which reproduce a theory which at low energy looks like particular gauge theory with matter content, and we can ask whether there's a sensible strong coupling limit of these theories. So what would it mean in the geometric interpretation? Well, the geometric interpretation, as I mentioned up there, is that the area of sigma should go to zero. So what we've done is we've made a degeneration in two steps. We've first taken the Calabi-Yau manifold X, which contained on it a one complex parameter family of CP1s, or something more if the gauge group was not SU2, the corresponding Dinkin diagrams. We shrunk that down to a singular Calabi-Yau manifold, which contains a Riemann surface along which you have the corresponding rational double point singularities as the transverse singularity, generically. And of course, I should point out that we're allowed to have some special points where something different happens. And then you make a further specialization where sigma shrinks to zero size. So I continue to specialize the metric and I push sigma down to zero size. Now, you could think of doing this all in one step through some path in the space of metrics in which you would just shrink this surface down to a point. And in my classification last time where I had A being curves going to points and D being surfaces going to curves and E being surfaces going to points, what I found is that the geometry, which is corresponding to a strong coupling limit of a regulated gauge theory, is the same as that which you would get by just shrinking the surface all the way down to a point. So whether you can do it now, whether you are able to factor that into two steps or not, we'll try to use that interpretation as the interpretation of what's happening when you contract this particular class of surfaces. So it sounds like that might have more or less solved the problem of figuring out what the limits were. It doesn't quite, because there are some surfaces which can be contracted to points which don't have this kind of ruling on them, and which under no conceivable circumstances would you be able to do a factorization like that. So let me just mention, again, going back to the Delpezzo surfaces, if I'm contracting a single surface to a point on a Calabi-Yau manifold, and if P is a canonical singularity, and I guess I'm going to assume that S is non-singular, then that implies that this S is one of these Delpezzo surfaces which have shown up in these lectures several times in for different reasons. So that means either S is a blow-up in some number of points of P2, where the number of points is less than or equal to 8, or S is P1 cross P1. Now, in each of these cases, if S is P1 cross P1, or K is at least 1, then, in fact, S has a ruling. So it has a map to some sigma with fibers, with generic fiber being CP1. And you can imagine applying this process of a two-step degeneration. It's not necessarily true that you always can. It may be that the way that S is embedded into the Calabi-Yau manifold, you cannot independently control the size of the fiber in the base in this situation. What happens is that the map from the second cohomology of X to the second cohomology of S is not required to be surjective, and it may be that you do not have independent sizes to play with. But if the principle is correct, that the local behavior is determined by the local structure of the singularities, then you can learn about the physics by working in a situation in which you have this two-step process available and then abstracting to this more general situation where it might not be available. So the conclusion is that for this simple class where I'm shrinking a single surface, everything could be understood as strong coupling limit of a corresponding gauge theory. What are those gauge theories? Well, you can work out that if you have n of these singular fibers, that corresponds to an SU2 theory with n charged hypermultiplets. And that's a theory which is known to have, in field theory, the global symmetry in field theory. It's not actually realized in the string theory model, but there's a global symmetry in field theory, which is SO2N for these guys. So that's, in fact, why I labeled those theories as DN theories. So those are the actual gauge theories themselves. Now, a thing like this with N singular fibers can always be written as the blow-up at N points of, well, either P1 cross P1 or the blow-up at N points of the other Hertzebruch surface, F1. There are only two possible... Well, if N... let me just say it this way. It's either the blow-up at N points of P1 cross P1 or it's this Hertzebruch surface, F1, which happens to be the blow-up of P2 at one point. And this one could be written as the blow-up Well, I'm, apologize. The better way to do it is to say that this is the blow up of the Hirzebruch surface, or else it's P1 cross P1. And this one can be thought of as a blow up at n plus 1 points of P2. So if I'm interested in this class of things where I am contracting a surface to a curve, I can regard the Del Pezzo surface S as being, well, what I really want is En, I want the labeling to come out so that En plus 1 corresponds to this Del Pezzo surface S, which is the blow up of P2 in n plus 1 points, or there's some alternative version S equals P1 cross P1 as E1 tilde, something like that. And here there was a D0 tilde, which corresponded to the P1 cross P1. So this should be thought of as a strong coupling limit of the above, of the DN, the SU2 with N charge hypermultiplets. And just to finish this chart, if I had a U1 with N charged hypermultiplets, where N is at least 1, then that can be described geometrically as some collection of N P1s, which are all shrinking down to a single point. So that is a theory that has a global symmetry of SUN. This one has a global symmetry of SO2N. And there are some arguments based on an alternate realization which tell you that the global symmetry of these theories is En plus 1. I'm very tempted to take the digression needed for this alternate realization of these theories. I think what I want to do, though, is wait and see how much time I have at the end and do that as the very last thing. So the discussion of why there's some E group that shows up here, other than just the labeling that I've been using, just natural way of labeling Del Pezzo surfaces, the discussion of that is something I want to postpone to the very end. See if I have time. So one thing which we learned is that strong coupling limits of gauge theories do not completely exhaust the possibilities because of this case here of P2 itself, E0. So the E0 theory is not a strong coupling limit of anything. And it and its cousins, other sorts of things where you might contract configurations of surfaces to points which do not admit a ruling or a compatible collection of rulings which makes it look like it's ruled by Dinkin diagrams generically, those are, I have to say, physically the most mysterious at the moment of these singularities. This E0, this contraction of P2 to a point, has a lot of very nice properties, but it's quite mysterious what role it really plays in everything.
Doesn't have a dilaton.
Doesn't have a dilaton. Doesn't have a dilaton. Its global symmetries are trivial. It's, you know, I should also point out it, because Robert pointed out the units of Yang-Mills theory. These are unlike the fixed points. So what's expected in the physical description is some kind of fixed point that is being studied here when you take these limits. But unlike some of the fixed points that we've encountered in other contexts where you got a fixed point in the infrared to which the other theories have flowed, I always want to say have flown, these are ultraviolet fixed points because strong coupling correlates to high energy in this particular case, to going into the to short distance, rather, going to the ultraviolet. So you have some ultraviolet fixed point which you know, there's some arguments must exist to describe these theories. And then if you move a little bit away from it, then you'll immediately flow down to some other kind of theory which has this low energy description as a gauge theory in the infrared. So we're working with ultraviolet fixed points. So that completes my rough catalog of what can happen to the boundaries of the Kähler cone at finite distance. I still haven't discussed in very much detail what happens to the boundaries of the Kähler cone, which are of the projectilized Kähler cone, which are at infinite distance. So at finite distance, we had these three basic possibilities. One was, one more remark about the strong coupling points, which is that there also, it seems, is there's a natural boundary that's happening at these strong coupling points, so these type E points. You really do get a boundary of the moduli space. And Coulomb branches, things which are behaving like Coulomb branches, can also exist here. In fact, it's a kind of remarkable coincidence that the same class of singularities which you see by going to finite volume limits of K3s from the perspective of these metrics, shrinking things down, seeing what you can blow down, or by moving around in a complex structure moduli space, which is where the hypermultiplet moduli are living, and going to limit points which, with respect to the natural metric, are at finite distance, you get the same class of singularities. In fact, the interpretation should be that these, in these cases where we have both Coulomb branches and the other one is called Higgs branch, the one that I'm moving in now within the vector multiplet moduli, in these cases, you're having two different ways of approaching the same kind of canonical singularity. One, in terms of a resolution, really, where you're blowing down the Calabi-Yau. That's the direction I've been discussing so far. But then once you have the singular Calabi-Yau, you can do a deformation of complex structure to smooth it out, and that's the approach to the canonical singularity in the other direction. So these gluing together of moduli spaces, which are things that I call extremal transitions, to include all of the types, not just the conifold or the gauge theory transitions, these extremal transitions are really should always be associated to canonical singularity that has both a smoothing and a resolution of singularities that remains Calabi-Yau. If you have both of those things, then in the resolution of singularity side, you'll be able to approach by going to the edge of the Kähler cone and shrinking down the sizes of the exceptional divisors, you'll be able to approach the singular space. And then the smoothing of the singular space gives you this additional Coulomb branch, additional complex structure moduli which connect that Calabi-Yau manifold to a different Calabi-Yau manifold. So we have this very large web of Calabi-Yau manifolds. And It's loosely conjectured that all Calabi-Yau manifolds, or maybe at least all Calabi-Yau manifolds with a fixed fundamental group, are connected in this way. We don't know too much about the structure of all Calabi-Yau manifolds, but people have made fairly extensive investigations of the large classes of Calabi-Yau manifolds that we do know about and have discovered that they all can be connected in this way by means of these extremal transitions. So we get this quite large space of theories with eight supersymmetries just by studying these Calabi-Yau manifolds and all of their connections. Well, what about limits at infinite distance? Approaching through vector multiplets. Well, there are two basic types. In one type, we can have a Calabi-Yau with a K3 fibration. Now, we ran into this principle once before in discussing F-theory, that if you have a duality, in the current case, I'll focus on the duality between M-theory on K3, which had an additional R16, and the heterotic theories on T3 cross R16. When you have a duality and you have a family of one of the objects in question, such as this family of K3 surfaces, then you can hope, say, by cutting out the points where there are bad fibers, small neighborhoods of those points, making local trivializations, gluing things together, you can hope to make sense of the dual family on the other side as being equivalent to the original one, possibly after making some corrections to the singular fibers. Now, in the F-theory discussion, the signal that we had to make some correction was this monodromy which happened on the tau field, which was reinterpreted on the 2B side as the two scalars in 10-dimensional 2B theory, and then there was a source term that was needed in the 2B theory to account for that, which is why we ended up with an insertion of 7 brains. Here, the monodromy that occurs in such a family of K3 surfaces on a Calabi-Yau manifold is relatively harmless. Monodromy is harmless. And the experience with a lot of examples tells us that apparently the fiber-wise duality extends to compact families. So here in 5 dimensions, monodromy on the K3 fibration. Around singular fibers, the K3 will acquire singularities at certain points. And, there may not be even...
You mean monodromy on the K3 homology?
On the diffeomorphism group, on the homology, on whatever you like. Whatever monodromy... if you're trying to write things as a family of field theories where the field theories are living on the fibers, then you would expect some kind of monodromy on that field theory. That's right, but it's very highly restricted. That's what replaces SL2Z. It has to be from a much smaller subgroup because, for example, you have to have algebraic K3s. You have to have an invariant class, right, because you have a hyperplane class on the Calabi-Yau threefold, which restricts to a hyperplane class on all the K3s. So the monodromy gets cut down quite severely. I'm in M theory. Actually, it's not 0420, it's 0319. So the compact families would be the M theory on the Calabi-Yau cross R14, matching some kind of heterotic models on, you might have to do K3 cross S1 mod some finite group or something like that on the same R14. You might expect to find dualities of this kind when you get K3 fibrations. This hasn't been investigated enough to know exactly which K3 fibrations actually will admit heterotic duals. I'm actually, in some sense, almost more optimistic about that, given some remarks that we heard from John Morgan, in which we learned that the traditional understanding of what all the moduli are for these heterotic toroidal compactifications is maybe a little bit limited because that's going to give some more flexibility for building things of this kind. Let me point out, though, that when you do make this mapping, the area of the base of this vibration, that's some P1, the area of the base goes over to the heterotic dilaton. And in fact, what sort of limit did we want to take? Well, we wanted to take a limit in which, in this Calabi-Yau case that was K3 fibered, we wanted to take a limit in which the volume was held constant, but the sizes of the fibers went to zero, and that means the area of the base is going to infinity. And in fact, the area of the base going to infinity limit corresponds to weak coupling on the heterotic side. So the interpretation of this limit point in the moduli space is that, hopefully you can always write it as a heterotic model, and if you can, then it's really the natural weak coupling limit of the heterotic compactification. So it ought to have been described in heterotic terms under those circumstances. Now, it's not clear to me right at the moment whether... or not, all possible transitions and gluings of moduli spaces, such as we've been discussing here in the Calabi-Yau case, if you look at all possible transitions like that in the heterotic case, whether they will always have Calabi-Yau counterparts. So it's not completely clear whether you can kind of get away from the locus of all Calabi-Yau theories, perhaps move among some heterotic theories and then move back to other kinds of Calabi-Yau theories and maybe even change the fundamental group of the Calabi-Yau. There's some indications that that might be possible. There are more indications that it's possible in four dimensions than in five dimensions, where the additional parameter that we get in the vector multiplet in four dimensions actually has the possibility of connecting up even more families than I'm discussing here. Up in five dimensions, I think it's a little less clear right now. So we could imagine doing a similar kind of analysis about the various heterotic theories on various kinds of spaces like this with different bundles, different structure, different gauge groups being chosen and so on, and trying to learn how all those link together. And that might give us additional directions in which to extend this large web of moduli spaces that we already built. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know of a way to see it on the heterotic side. It might be ambiguous, right? And in particular, if you do a kind of, you know, topology changing or bundle changing transformation here, even if you could encode the data, you might be able to change it on the heterotic side. Even though it doesn't look like you can change it on the M theory side. But remember, to make this duality, I took a constant volume Calabi-Yau in a certain limit where the area of the base was getting large. And now, to make a large volume Calabi-Yau, on top of that, tunes the parameters on the heterotic side in some funny way. So that's not necessarily a limit I want to go to. Right. In particular, there might be some limit point in the heterotic side in which you would get one fundamental group out, and some limit, another limit point in the heterotic side where you get a different fundamental group out. Right? It might be associated to those limits somehow. The other kind of infinite distance limit is the case of a Calabi-Yau with an elliptic vibration. So if there exists a section, this should have an F-theory description. If there only exists, there has to exist some kind of multi-section, some finite to one, or generically finite to one map from some multi-section down to the base. But when you take the limits of the elliptic curves going to zero area with multi-sections, you might think that your theory ought to decompactify up to six dimensions, but it doesn't seem to be a purely local six-dimensional theory. There seems to be some remnant of that multi-section business which interferes with having a purely local six-dimensional theory. So I don't know a good way to say what happens if there's not a section at the moment. But let's just study the cases where there is a section. Then we'll get these F-theory models. So we have these six-dimensional F-theory models. And just as we were learning about some exotic new kinds of physics, strong coupling limits of dNs or even more exotic things like these E0s in five dimensions, we can learn about some new kinds of physics in six dimensions. So this is the maximal dimension in which this supersymmetry can occur. It's the 1-0 supersymmetry in six dimensions. And we can learn about some exotic points here by studying the geometry of these F-theory models. We can also try to compare F-theory and heterotic models if we're in the situation of a Calabi-Yau manifold, which has both a K3 vibration and an elliptic vibration. And actually, you need for the elliptic vibration to fiber the K3s in the K3 vibration. So you need a doubly fibered Calabi-Yau manifold. In that very special case, then there will also be a six-dimensional heterotic interpretation of these models. So what happened? Well, I had a Calabi-Yau threefold mapping to some complex surface here, and the fibers were elliptic curves. A little bit unlike the situation from F theory in 8 dimensions, I now have various curves, complex curves, sitting inside this base manifold along which the elliptic vibration degenerates. So typically, each of these components is associated to an enhanced gauge symmetry group using the same kind of association that was discussed earlier in both the K3 case and also in the enhanced gauge symmetry in M theory case. Namely, there's a Kodaira fiber that's the generic fiber over that point. You contract all the components of that Kodaira fiber other than the one meeting the section, and the contraction of all those points gives you some enhanced gauge symmetry, which may be, may or may not be simply laced depending on whether there's monodromy on those fibers as you move along these curves. And then at certain special points along these curves, other strange things happen which can cause some amount of matter in these representations. Also, when the curves collide, you will get matter, typically in representations of the two groups that are meeting will occur at such points. And there's a really interesting zoo of phenomena to investigate from the structure of these elliptic vibrations and the possible singularity curves that can occur in the bases. Well, there are partial classifications. So if you ask for situations in which the two divisors meet normally, then there's a complete classification of what happens. However, in lots of interesting models, they don't meet normally. In fact, there tend to be high orders of tangency of some kind. And there's another approach to doing a classification, which I think has been partially carried out to figure out what happens for non-normal crossing things and see what all the matter representations are that you get. But it's really, there's a big list of things that can happen. There's just a lot of things that can happen. So again, the equations look like some polynomial. Well, I can write it as a polynomial in two variables. More properly, it's a section of some line bundle on the base, which I'm just locally representing as a polynomial in two variables. And there are two of these polynomials associated to sections of different line bundles, one being a fourth power and the other being a sixth power of a common underlying line bundle. And these kinds of equations now can be used to describe these six-dimensional models. And again, this quantity F cubed over 27 plus G squared over F cubed over 27 plus G squared over 4, the vanishing of this is what describes this set of curves here. There will be multiplicities depending on the type of gauge group that happens. And in fact, there are other conditions on F and G which determine what sort of gauge groups happen. And the possibilities are really vast in writing down models here. So let me try to focus on a concrete question. In six-dimensional physics, and the concrete question is going to be, what kinds of exotic fixed points can be constructed using these F-theory models? Oh, one thing I neglected to say. So in 6 dimensions, there's this tensor multiplet. And in fact, these models, well, if the if the Picard number of the base is bigger than 1, these models involve tensor multiplets. In fact, there are, generally speaking, H11 or B2 minus 1 tensor multiplets in this model. Now, That's a rather unusual state of affairs because people do not know ways of writing down Lagrangians which involve more than one tensor multiplet. And so whenever you have a base whose Picard number is bigger than one, in fact, the maximum Picard number of the base that can occur is not known to me. It's certainly finite, but I don't know what it is. I know that on a couple of occasions I thought I found the largest one, and then I found some other tricky model where you could have a few more blow-ups. Pardon? Because I can realize all these things by blowing up Hertzebruch surfaces and in the algebraic families. So the issue is, when do you have to... Yeah, so ask me again in 5 minutes. I can answer it better after I've said something else. So what exotic fixed points can be constructed using F-theory models, and other questions such as how many tensor multiplets can you get, or why should you be getting models with many tensor multiplets? Well, we've had a sort of rough classification of the types of phenomena that can occur on a Calabi-Yau manifold. Namely, if we contract curves to points or surfaces to curves, then there's a good field theory description of what's happening, and that field theory description translates, as it did in the case of K3 surfaces, up to a knowledge of what the gauge group that's part of this theory is in the six-dimensional model. So the source of these exotic fixed points should be divisors contracting to points on X. Now, for this divisor contracting to point on X to have, so I imagine that I've got X, which was mapping to S, and now I have some way of contracting a divisor to a point. If this contraction of a divisor to a point, I should also point out that in these Weierstrass models, well, I should have quoted a theorem about how you could make, when you had a Calabi-Yau threefold with an elliptic vibration, provided that you only had canonical or terminal singularities, you could blow up the base in an appropriate way to get another Calabi-Yau model in which the family was flat. And in particular, that means that the fiber dimension is always one for these original models that I have. So I won't be encountering a situation where I have some divisor here which contracts to a point and doesn't disturb the existence of the fibration. The fibration itself will be disturbed by such a contraction. In fact, that divisor, since it can't map to a point, will have to map down to a curve. Well, if I contract a section, if I tried to contract an entire section, then I would lose the ability to go to this F-theory limit at all. So I don't want to contract a section. I'll just take divisors which map to a curve, and then I'll have some kind of singular model where the Calabi-Yau has acquired some canonical singularity here. And the surface S bar has acquired potentially some singularities as well. So the way to answer this concrete question is to study all possible kind of degenerate Calabi-Yau, elliptically fibered Calabi-Yaus, where canonical singularities are allowed and where you have to put into the base whatever singularities you have to put into the base. So let me tell you the simplest such situation. Simplest such situation is when S bar is non-singular. And we're simply blowing up S bar at that particular point, moving from now a Calabi-Yau space with definitely a singular fiber over P to a non-singular Calabi-Yau space. These are elliptic vibrations. Well, it's not too hard to analyze what kind of singularity you need to put into this total space in order for the pullback of this elliptic vibration to the blow-up at that point to give you a Calabi-Yau space, in particular a non-singular Calabi-Yau space. You have to impose certain vanishing conditions at P of orders 4 and 6, 8 and 12, 4 and 6, on the polynomials or sections of line bundles, F and G. So you have to put in a certain vanishing order there. And what you create is a type of singularity on the Calabi-Yau manifold. So you create this kind of canonical singularity, which is essentially a cone over Del Pezzo of degree 1. Well, excuse me, over a rational elliptic surface. So that's related by a flop, one of these flops, to a cone over Del Pezzo of degree 1. And in fact, this particular kind of exotic fixed point in six dimensions is naturally associated to this kind of E8 singularity. That was what we called the ones that were cones over Del Pezzos back in five dimensions, after you've done this this flop in five dimensions. What are we doing when we approach, when we take the 2B compactification on S and approach the compactification on S bar? Well, this had some kind of exceptional locus, which was shrinking down to zero size here. And the size of that exceptional locus is going down to zero. When that size reaches zero in six-dimensional language, so I've kind of got the area of E, when that reaches zero, I get to this exotic point here. That's in the six-dimensional limit. Now, I could also take the area of the T2s, sort of plot that on a vertical axis. And this point that I'm making about the flop is just that there's a line here, which is some kind of flop transition that has to be done, so that if you were in five dimensions, before you ever got to the area of E shrinking, you would have to do a flop. But you do that flop later and later, as it were, as the area of T2 gets smaller and smaller. And in six dimensions, the things sort of happen simultaneously.
Do you have a K3 vibration there?
Nope.
Nothing.
Just an elliptic vibration. Right.
So what is E?
E is...
E in your diagram
E is
fiber, right?
E is pi inverse of P. The T2 is the elliptic fiber, and the E is the thing that I'm blowing up from S bar to S.
Not necessarily an elliptic curve.
In fact, it's P1. It's called E because it's the exceptional divisor. So blowing down a P1 in the simplest possible way to a non-singular point, you end up with this particular kind of limit, which is closely related to the Del Pezzos of degree 1, related to them by some flop that you have to do in order to get over to that kind of limiting point in five-dimensional terms. Similarly, you can start now to catalog the various kinds of things that can happen as you do blow-ups or multiple blow-ups, as you allow more complicated singularities to occur in the fibers, and get very interesting lists of six-dimensional fixed points. You could also try to arrive at lists of interesting six-dimensional fixed points from other points of view, such as gauge theories or looking for interesting kind of cancellations of anomalies, which would suggest the existence of certain fixed points. And those studies match pretty well. So there were some papers about a year ago which kind of matched up the various ways that you might end up getting six-dimensional fixed points from that point of view. So doing a blow-up like this increases the Betti number of the base and therefore increases the number of tensor multiplets. On the other hand, in order to do it, I had to impose a severe restriction on the simultaneous vanishing of F and G at that point that I blew up. So I can regard this family as a limiting case of the family of non-singular Calabi-Yaus over S-bar. And in fact, I can do all the blowdowns to get down to a kind of minimal surface, allowing a lot of pretty bad singularities in a Calabi-Yau space, but fitting everything into a common family. And now if you just take some, you know, stratification of that space by singularity type, You get a list of all the that's not practical to do in practice, but you would get a list of all the possible degenerate Calabi-Yaus which could be occurring, and then for each one you just have to blow it up, see how many times you blew it up, and count the number of tensor multiples that you got. That, in principle, is how you answer the question, what's the maximal number, and that's why I know there is a maximal number. I should tell you that there are only finitely many Hertzebruch surfaces that can ever occur as the end result of this blowdown process, because there's a lower bound on the self-intersection of a curve that can occur. Okay, well, I've given a reasonably thorough survey of the sorts of phenomena that can happen for eight supercharges, so let me go ahead and come back and just briefly tell you this thing I postponed about why there is an associated E group here. So there's another physical situation with similar properties, believed to be identical properties, in fact, to these ways, using Calabi-Yau manifolds, of studying five-dimensional physics, and that is to consider the intrinsic physics on D4 brains which have been added to a type 1 prime compactification in 9 dimensions. So what do I mean that these have been added? Well, there was this notion promulgated about a year and a half ago of using brains as probes. There's a classical idea that you learn in freshman physics of measuring an electric field by putting in a little test particle, and seeing what happens to the test particle. Here we'd like to measure the properties of this type 1 prime compactification in 8 plus 1 dimensions by putting in a little probe, a D4 brain, which is going to feel the effects of the background and whose intrinsic physical theory is going to tell us a lot about the surroundings that it finds itself in. So the type 1 prime compactification was the one in which I had these orientifold planes. I was compactifying on S1 mod Z2. I had these orientifold planes at the ends. And then I was supposed to put 16 D8 brains, Dirichlet 8 brains, inside someplace. The parameters of the theory include the positions of these brains. In fact, in the Higgs branch, that's exactly what the parameters are. It's just the positions of the brains. Now, the forebrain is now put in there someplace, and as it moves around, it should be able to detect the presence of the eight brains. Well, in fact, crossing one of these eight brains turns out to be one of these transitions between two parts of the moduli space, such as we described earlier. So, in fact, if the eight brains are separated, crossing one of the eight brains will produce a kind of A0 theory. It's a U1 with one charged hypermultiplet. So the local description of the five-dimensional physics is the same thing as you would find from these M-theory models compactified in Calabi-Yau manifolds with a single P1 contracting. If I happen to have a background in which a bunch of these brains are on top of each other, then when the forebrain moves past them, it will experience an AN-1 type singularity. The physics described here as U1 with n charged hypermultiplets instead of a single one. And the global symmetries in the brain, in the D4 brain theory will correspond to the gauge symmetry in the space-time theory, which we recognize in this particular case as having been enhanced to SUN. So that's a general principle in this analysis, that the global symmetry in the field theory and the gauge symmetry in the 8 plus 1 dimensional spacetime will be the same. Well, it's that principle which is going to let us determine the global symmetry in these E theories. So now, what is a D theory? Well, a D theory is produced by clumping together some of these D8 brains, but not at an interior point of the compactification, putting it out here at the orientifold boundary. And now, when the now you're going to get a parameter space for the five-dimensional theory, which has an end to it, as we've seen in other contexts, and that is the parameter space for an SU2 theory with n charged hypermultiplets. If I've gone ahead and piled n of the D8 brains out at that particular orientifold plane, and well, as I've mentioned before. The gauge symmetry in spacetime associated with placing n of those brains on top of the orientifold plane is SO2n, so that becomes the global symmetry of our five-dimensional theory in this particular case. Now, for the E theories other than E0, we represented those as strong coupling limits of these D theories. So you can go back over here and try to analyze the parameters and see whether there's some parameter that can be used to tune the coupling and send it to a strong coupling limit. Indeed, there is, and there are some independent arguments based on this situation about why SU2 with at most 7 charged hypermultiplets should have a sensible strong coupling limit, whereas if you were to put more than 7 charged hypermultiplets on it, you would not get a sensible strong coupling limit, some beta function calculation. And so one argues, both on that basis and on the basis of the duality to the heterotic theory on S1, as I'll mention in a moment, that there must exist these kind of ultraviolet fixed points, which are strong coupling limits of these theories in this particular situation. So, interpreted on the heterotic side, in fact, we know that the heterotic string on compactified on S1 can indeed involve E80, 76, this whole E series of groups, as gauge symmetry groups. So if we're in a configuration which gives such a gauge symmetry group, then we should be able to model that configuration over in the type 1 prime side through some kind of configuration here. And when you match the parameters, you discover that the limit that goes from the dn to the en plus 1 on the heterotic side maps over here to some limit in which the coupling constant, the effective coupling constant in the five-dimensional theory, gets large. So the argument for the existence of these theories up through down through E1 and E1 tilde is based on that kind of analysis, in part the duality with the heterotic string.
That's cool, because the heterotic string was a five-dimensional.
The heterotic string on.
Because you have to
Okay, I need to probe the. I need to put a probe into the five prime,
so
into
the
heterotic string.
Okay.
And
that's got to be the heterotic wrapping.
That's fine. Well, I was arguing. Sure. I was making the argument slightly less directly and saying that before inserting the probe, I knew that I could get to a space-time gauge symmetry of En somehow here, and so I had to be able to get the space-time gauge symmetry of En over here, and then that's going to be reflected in the global symmetry of the probe theory. But you're right, I should also be able to put the probe over here. But then a heterotic five brain, I don't understand how to analyze it as well, I think. So you end up deciding that there are these theories with these En gauge symmetries. Now, what about this E0? Well, the E0 shows up in a very funny kind of transition where the parameter space for these theories from the type 1 prime point of view really seems to be incomplete. And you get some region in the parameter space which is described well by including the positions of all these brains and also some gauge coupling, which is allowed to go to infinity and possibly enhance this from a D to an E. But it's missing some parts of the heterotic moduli space. And there's a funny kind of transition which happens in which the orientifold plane, you don't even need any D-brains on the end of it, in which the orientifold plane is somehow changed into something new. I need even another color. So it's changed into a kind of strongly coupled orientifold plane, or a kind of, I've never known what to call this. It's an E0 plane now. Now, when it goes from an ordinary orientifold plane to an E0 plane, it actually emits an additional D8 brain. So that can happen on one side or on the other side. And if it happens on one side, you now have a theory with, say, an E0 plane on one side, an orientifold plane on the other side, and 17 8 brains in it. Or if it's happened on both sides, you can have two E0 planes as the boundary and 18 E8 brains, 18 D8 brains. Those are not independent anymore. They cannot be all tuned independently. But you can do things such as bring all 18 of them together. And if you bring all 18 of them together, you find an SU18 enhanced gate symmetry. And SU18, actually, it's SU18 mod Z3. And the fact that there's a mod Z3 is somehow related to the fact that you didn't have independent positions of 8 brains anymore. And SU18 mod Z3 is indeed one of the possible enhanced gate symmetry groups in the heterotic string, which is impossible to explain if you didn't have some kind of enhancement with E0 planes of this kind. So that's one of the arguments for the existence of this very strange kind of limit of the type 1 prime theory. It's actually, it's almost a different phase of the theory, because you have, there's a whole other 17 parameter family on the other side of that transition, where you're now moving around 17 or 18 brains with their positions somewhat constrained. But those correspond to these more exotic E0 theories.
What's done on the heterotic?
Well, all I'm telling you is that this mapping, the mapping from these positions into the heterotic moduli space, just fills out an open set. I agree with you that I should know better where the boundary is that marks off that open set from the rest of the heterotic moduli, but I don't actually, I've never worked that out. No, it's an open set. It's an open set. They're open sets.
So there are two open sets. There's one where.
Actually, I guess the ends are identifiable, right? So there are four open sets, depending on whether I'm using an orientifold or an E0 at each end.
So it sounds like they should be disjoint open sets.
But they're not.
E0 is different from.
There's a transition from one to the other. From the type 1 perspective, there's definitely a transition. You tune the parameters to a certain value, and now you can keep going, and when you keep going, an extra D-brain is emitted.
Right, so that sounds like a disjoint.
No, they're open sets meeting in codimension 1.
Right.
So there are these sort of four sets, and this is a picture of the 17-dimensional parameter space somehow. And the traditional type 1 prime description only gets a quarter of the space. That's the claim.
Is there any natural way of dividing up?
That's what I told you. I've been meaning to work out for about a year and a half and haven't ever gotten around to it. Okay, so the last little thing I will tell you is that this analysis with these symmetry groups can be used to predict the structure, or at least the local structure, of the Coulomb branch of these theories. So the predicted structure of the Coulomb branch is that you should have the moduli space of four-dimensional Euclidean instantons for G, for this group G. So why does that happen? Well, what happens is if I put the four brain on top of the eight brain, then there are four transverse Euclidean directions in which we can now have some fluctuations. And those new parameters, which are the new parameters appearing in the Coulomb branch, are described as one of these very familiar instanton moduli spaces. So we look at moduli spaces of instantons for these various bundles, and the dimension of those moduli spaces of instantons, at the very least, will predict something about the dimension of the Coulomb branch for now these geometric situations, including, for example, statements for low values of D and E to the effect that the moduli space of instantons is reducible. That's because the group is semi-simple but not simple. It has several semi-simple factors. And so you'll have the ability to separately specify the instanton data for those two factors in the group, giving you two different kinds of components on this space. I said that a little bit wrong. I can go in either one and find Coulomb branches associated to either one of those groups. I have the option of doing either one. Well, if you then try to match, so that makes a very concrete prediction for what sort of smoothing components exist and what their dimensions are and how many there are if you make very specific kinds of geometric contractions on a Calabi-Yau manifold. And those have been, rather surprising predictions in some sense. When people had looked at the question of what was the structure of the Coulomb branch, they had found that there were results that had no apparent pattern. And this actually predicts all those results, predicts additional results, many of which have since been verified, and gives a kind of common formulation for all the phenomena that are known to happen in this situation. So I guess I'll stop there.